Lecture 9, John Maynard Keynes and the Keynesian Revolution.
John Maynard Keynes lived life as if he had more than 24 hours in every day. That's the only way I can explain the remarkable amount that he managed to accomplish. He was born in 1883 and lived until 1946, just after World War II. His father, John Neville Keynes, was a prominent economist of his time. His mother was a justice of the peace and actually the mayor of the town of Cambridge. He went to Cambridge University, where he studied math and classics and was a student of Alfred Marshall's in economics. He worked in civil service in India for a couple of years and then returned to Cambridge as a professor. What was it that he crammed into his day, or why would he make himself so busy? One thing was, Keynes had a golden touch as an investor. He and David Ricardo were clearly the two economists who knew how to make money. He made a fortune for himself. He made a fortune for the Royal Economics Society, which was Britain's association of professional economists. He made money for King's College at Cambridge, where he managed the endowment. For 18 years, he ran a life insurance company, where he was chairman of the board. The story was that Keynes would sit around for a little while each morning reading the paper in his bathrobe, and then he would call his broker and make his stock market trades, and made a lot of money doing it. In addition to writing economics books and articles, he also wrote on statistics, mathematics. He wrote some lovely biographical essays, including the one on Alfred Marshall that I quoted from earlier. He was by reputation a great teacher, hosting seminars in his home commonly, and for over 30 years, from 1911 to 1945, he was the editor of the Economic Journal, which was at that time one of the one or two most prestigious economic journals in the world. In his spare time, while in society, he was thought of as a member of the Bloomsbury Group, which included Virginia Woolf, E.M. Forster, and others. He was a patron of ballet and theater. He was an esteemed and well-known rare book and manuscript collector. He also played an active role in government, of course. Early in his life, he was the principal representative for the British Treasury for the peace conference that followed World War I. He wrote at the time that the reparations payments being forced on Germany were far too extreme and were going to lead to instability in Germany, which could create another world war. And of course, as events turned out, he was right about that. Late in life, after World War II, when his health was fading, he led the British delegation to the Bretton Woods Conference in the United States. That was the conference that established the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, a way of keeping exchange rates from jumping around. He was named a baron in 1942. I say, I don't know how he did it all. It's almost inconceivable. To see how highly he was esteemed, I want to quote from his obituary in The Economist, a British news magazine. And I'll skip through the obituary and just mention a few sentences. "The sudden death of Lord Keynes on Easter morning has removed a great man. In turn, civil servant, pamphleteer, don and college bursar, editor, company chairman, patron of the arts, government spokesman and advisor, member of the upper house. He touched no career that he did not brilliantly adorn. The story is told that when he was appointed a director of the Bank of England, he was accused by a friend of turning orthodox in his old age, and he replied with his perfect self-assurance, 'You are wrong. Orthodoxy has caught up with me.' What would have been conceit in another was simple truth in his case. He had the gift that comes only to real leaders of being well ahead of his generation, and yet able to pull it along behind him. It must be left to posterity to say just how great a man Keynes was. But what posterity will never know, for as he said, in the long run we are all dead, is the charm of the man, the devastating brilliance of his conversation, the quickness of his intuition, his ready generosity, or the unsparing devotion to the public interest that finally killed him." An extraordinary person. The reference to killing him was working at the Bretton Woods Conference at the end of his life when he was ill and fading, but refused to leave until the conference had completed its work. He packed several lifetimes into one, but our focus here is really going to be on his economic work and thinking about what was new and different about his economic theories. The capstone of these views is probably his book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, which is published in 1936. But before getting to that work, it's important to lay down some stepping stones for how Keynes saw the world developing at about the time he was writing. The first stepping stone is that at the time Keynes is doing a lot of his professional work, the end of World War I, the 20s into the 30s and World War II, there was a real sense of economic stagnation in the air, a real sense of instability. There was a feeling that just after World War I, investment opportunities were running out, that technology might have slowed down. In his essay, The Economic Consequences of the Peace, written in 1919, he said the significant features of the immediate situation can be grouped under three heads. First, the absolute falling off for the time being in Europe's internal productivity. Second, the breakdown of transport and exchange by means of which its products could be conveyed where they were wanted. And third, the inability of Europe to purchase its usual supplies from overseas. And he summed up by saying, an inefficient, unemployed, disorganized Europe faces us, torn by internal strife and international hate, fighting, starving, pillaging, and lying. Dark colors. There is a sense for him that the economy and the world were really somehow almost breaking down in certain ways. He believed that the capitalistic class was close to collapse. And again, quoting from Economic Consequences of the Peace, you should listen for the Schumpeter-like echoes in this phrase. We are thus faced in Europe with the spectacle of an extraordinary weakness on the part of the great capitalist class, which has emerged from the industrial triumphs of the 19th century and seemed a very few years ago our all-powerful master. The terror and personal timidity of the individuals of this class is now so great, their confidence in their place in society and in their necessity to the social organism so diminished, that they are the easy victims of intimidation. This was not so in England 25 years ago, any more than it is now in the United States. Then the capitalists believed in themselves, in their value to society, in the propriety of their continued existence, in the full enjoyment of their riches, and the unlimited exercise of their power. Now they tremble before every insult. Call them pro-Germans, international financiers, or profiteers, and they will give you any ransom you choose to ask, not to speak of them so harshly. They allow themselves to be ruined and altogether undone by their own instruments, by governments of their own making, and a press of which they are proprietors. So there is this sense in Keynes of the economy and the capitalist institutions lacking confidence and falling back in on themselves. And if you think of the time after World War I or the Great Depression, certainly that would tend to shake anybody's faith in whether or not capitalist institutions were going to be very strong. However, at the same time, there's another stepping stone for Keynes. And that other stepping stone is a belief that in the long run, we will have economic progress in much the way that Schumpeter believed we would in the long run have economic progress. In fact, Keynes writes in a couple of his essays that he fully accepts that over time, the economy will grow at about 2% a year, just in the same way that Schumpeter predicted. Now think for a moment about what that means. At a 2% rate of growth, the economy will double roughly every 36 years once you take compounding of growth rates into effect. So after 36 years, the economy will have doubled. After another 36 years, the economy will have doubled again, so it will be four times as large as it was at the beginning. Over a century, 108 years, it will have doubled yet a third time to eight times what it was earlier. In 1930, at the front edge of the Great Depression, Keynes, with his good contrarian streak, wrote an essay about economic possibilities for our grandchildren, based on this notion that growth would be continuing over the long term. And he said, I draw the conclusion that, assuming no important wars and no important increase in population, the economic problem may be solved, or at least within sight of solution, within 100 years. This means that the economic problem is not, if we look into the future, the permanent problem of the human race. Thus, for the first time since his creation, man will be faced with his real, his permanent problem. How to use his freedom from pressing economic cares, how to occupy the leisure which with science and compound interest will have won for him to live wisely and agreeably and well. So somehow, Keynes believed in the short run, everything looked pretty terrible. In the long run, sure, we're going to have growth, and for our grandchildren, they will be much better off than we are. Now, how do we resolve these views? How do we see these views today? At first glance, it could easily seem like these are just flatly in contradiction with each other. But actually, I think that many economists sort of balance these out in their own minds in a way similar to what Keynes did. In the long run, capitalism and markets do generate a kind of growth over time through this process of innovation. But as that happens, there's a lot of grinding of gears. There's difficulties that happen along the way as the economy goes into recessions or comes out, as people are displaced from jobs, as new technologies are invented, with foreign trade and all the rest.
Keynes is essentially, I think, making an argument that over time, we want to let this process happen. And it will happen, and it will be a good thing that it happens. But we need to worry some about the process that we're going through. We need to worry about that short-run turmoil. We need to worry about fixing some of the immediate problems we face. And it's not enough to say with Schumpeter, well, you know, in 50 or 100 years, everything will be fine. We need to focus on some of the difficulties that we face immediately at that time. So Keynes wrote in his 1930 essay, "Chiefly, do not let us overestimate the importance of the economic problem, or sacrifice to its supposed necessities other matters of greater and more permanent significance. It should be a matter for specialists, like dentistry. If economists could manage to get themselves thought of as humble, competent people on a level with dentists, that would be splendid." Now, Keynes's view here is open to criticism in at least a couple of different ways. It is true that our standard of living has climbed higher and higher and higher over time. But I think it's difficult, even though we have had the growth that he predicted over the long term, to say, well, you know, our economic problems are pretty much almost solved. We've pretty much fixed everything. Everyone's pretty much happy. We don't have to worry about scarcity anymore. Clearly, our desires and our needs keep going up, even as our productivity keeps going up. And so somehow his sense that we would reach this happy state where we didn't have to worry about that anymore is not quite accurate somehow. You remember that John Stuart Mill was looking forward to the peacefulness of the steady state back in 1848. While Keynes is looking forward to it in 1930, I would say we're still looking forward to it today. And so I'm not altogether sure that this future time when we will all have everything we want and we don't need to worry about material things is really anywhere on the horizon at the moment. Second question, will growth really look out for itself? Is Keynes really right to just sort of say, let's worry about the short-term problems because in the long run this growth will just kind of take place and occur? I wonder what Keynes would say now if he had watched the standard of living in Britain, which toward the turn of the century was just about the highest of the world, only a little bit behind the United States. If he had watched that decline and decline and decline over time, to now where Britain is below the average standard of living for Europe as a whole, would Keynes still say, well, long run, growth will take care of itself? Or would he say, you know, maybe we do need to worry a little bit more about whether this growth is actually going to happen. Also, of course, in many countries of the world, desperately poor countries in Africa, China, Southeast Asia, places like that, those are places where it's a little harder to say, well, you know, long-run growth will take care of itself. They desperately need growth. And so I think that Keynes is perhaps just a little too casual about saying growth will happen in the long run. Let's not worry too much about the long run. That'll all work its way out. Let's worry about the short run instead. Let's now contemplate Keynes' general theory and what he's trying to say about the economy. I guess the opening point for thinking about the general theory is that this is a great book, and it's also an extraordinarily frustrating book to read. Let me, to describe that, quote Paul Samuelson, who is a great economist in his own right, a Nobel laureate, and in the late 1940s, he wrote the introductory economics textbook, which sort of defined how economics courses have been taught ever since. In an obituary he wrote for Keynes after Keynes' death, he described the general theory in this way, and this is a big fan of Keynesian economics. Samuelson wrote, "It's a badly written book, poorly organized. Any layman who, beguiled by the author's previous reputation, bought the book was cheated of his 5 shillings. It is not well suited for classroom use. It is arrogant, bad-tempered, polemical, and not overly generous in its acknowledgments. It abounds in mare's nests and confusions. In it, the Keynesian system stands out indistinctly, as if the author were hardly aware of its existence or cognizant of its properties. And certainly he is at his worst when expounding its relations to its predecessors. Flashes of insight and intuition intersperse tedious algebra. An awkward definition suddenly gives way to an unforgettable cadenza. When it finally is mastered, we find its analysis to be obvious and at the same time new. In short, it is a work of genius." And it is a work of genius. It's, like many works of genius, a frustrating one to deal with. The key question of the 1930s is, of course, why we're going through a Great Depression. Why the market collapsed so thoroughly. At the time, the standard answer was closely related to Schumpeter's answer. The economy goes up and down. There are these cycles. Sometimes we have a particularly sharp up or a particularly sharp down. That's just how it is. Keynes and others, when they heard Schumpeter and people like that argue that point of view, responded with a kind of horror that there was a major difference between the kind of correcting of a slight overreaction and a Great Depression, where there's 25 or 30% unemployment and the economy is shrinking by over 30% in a few years. They said, you know, sure, we believe that we need market institutions and, you know, sometimes firms need to go bankrupt. But this is not a little bit of correction. This is a terrible problem all its own. And so they felt that as the economy literally is seemed to be going under, that people like Schumpeter said, well, it's all just a pattern up and down, don't worry about it too much, that those people were just ignoring a terrible, terrible short-run problem. And what King sets out to explain in the general theory is, how can it be that the economy gets stuck so badly in that kind of a situation? Well, he begins by trying to explain how it is that the economy can be pulled apart into different pieces. In particular, he starts off by saying, in capital markets, it's not always clear that decisions to save will be equilibrated with decisions on how much to invest. Now, you remember, in the classical theory or in the neoclassical theory, we have supply of capital, we have demand of capital. We've got a supply and demand curve, we've got an interest rate, which is the price of capital, and these two are going to be set equal to each other by the market. So the market will help balance out the supply and demand for capital. If there's lots of people who want to borrow money, then that'll tend to push the interest rate up. And that'll encourage more people to save. If nobody wants to borrow money, then that'll tend to push the interest rate down. There won't be any demand for capital, and that will tend to discourage people from saving. So these two things will work together, supply and demand, just like any other market. Keynes looks at this point of view and says, this just isn't right in practice. How is it that savings actually happen? Do I look out there in the economy and see a pattern where, as interest rates go up and down, people sometimes save a little and sometimes save a lot? Keynes said, no, that doesn't seem to be the pattern I actually see. What we see is that people save more or less the same amount. I mean, some people save 5% a year or 10% a year, but people who save just take some money and put it aside. And that's what they do. It's kind of a flat amount. It doesn't rise or fall a whole lot as the interest rate goes up and down. On the other hand, if we look at the demand for capital in terms of business investment and businesses that are demanding capital in order to invest, Keynes argues that that goes up and down a whole lot. It rises and falls a great deal, depending on whether the business thinks this is a good time to invest or a bad time to invest. And so when you look at business investment, you're going to be seeing big swings depending on what the climate for investment looks like. He writes, for example, in the general theory, in the case of durable assets, it is therefore natural and reasonable that expectations of the future should play a dominant part in determining the scale on which new investment is deemed advisable. But as we have seen, the basis for such future expectations is very precarious. Being based on shifting and unreliable evidence, they are subject to sudden and violent changes. So he argues that we're going to see saving sort of going along at a level and investment leaping up and down, depending on whether it seems like a good time to invest or not. Now, how does this affect the overall economy if we think about it in that way? It's going to mean that at some times there won't be enough investment to soak up the amount that people want to save. People will be saving a lot, but investment will be very, very, very low. So there won't be enough demand in the economy to soak up that savings. Other times we may have a problem that people want to invest lots and lots, but there's not enough being saved to provide that amount of capital. Keynes sometimes referred to this as saying that investors had what he called animal spirits. He said basically they just get excited about things and they rush out there and they invest. And those animal spirits are really what determine the amount of investment out there. So, we start off with the notion that savings and investment might be out of sync in the economy. Now, this will, of course, be even worse if stock markets and other markets for investment have a lot of speculation in them, because the speculation could be driving these cycles even larger and further than they would otherwise go. And Keynes was just scathing about stock market investors and how foolish the whole idea of stock markets was. He just offers one famous metaphor, one famous example after another. For example, he starts off at one point and says, "The actual object of the most skilled investment today is to beat the gun, as the Americans so well express it, to outwit the crowd. It doesn't have anything to do with whether the investment makes sense. It's just trying to beat the gun." At another point, he says, "Investment is, so to speak, a game of snap, of old maid, of musical chairs, a pastime in which he is the victor who says snap, neither too soon nor too late, who passes the old maid to his neighbor before the game is over, who secures a chair for himself when the music stops. These games can be played with zest and enjoyment, though all the players know that it is the old maid which is circulating. Or when the music stops, some of the players will find themselves unseated." So he's saying the stock market, you know, everyone's just buying and selling and trying to sell to somebody else. There's no logic to it. There's no sense to it. It's just a game that everybody's playing. Another example he gives, which is perhaps my favorite, he says professional investment may be likened to those newspaper competitions in which the competitors have to pick out the 6 prettiest faces from 100 photographs, the prize being awarded to the competitor whose choice most nearly corresponds to the average preferences of the competitors as a whole. So each competitor has to pick not those faces which he himself finds prettiest, but those which he thinks likeliest to catch the fancy of the other competitors, all of whom are looking at the problem from the same point of view. It is a case of choosing those which, it is not a case of choosing those which, to the best of one's judgment, are really the prettiest, nor even those which average opinion genuinely thinks the prettiest. We have reached the third degree, where we devote our intelligence to anticipating what average opinion expects average opinion to be. And there are some, I believe, who practice the fourth, fifth, and higher degrees. So in terms of stock market investment, he says we're not looking at companies and whether they make sense or not. We're anticipating what other people will think about companies. And we're anticipating how other people will anticipate what other people will anticipate about how other people anticipate what they think of companies. And in that world, the stock market can be going up and down. Investment can be going up and down. And there's no reason to believe that investment and savings are going to be matched up by that market. It's being driven by these sorts of animal spirits and craziness. In fact, Keynes goes so far as to propose that we should probably have a tax on speculation to slow it down and to have less speculation in the market. He wrote, "It is usually agreed that casinos should, in the public interest, be inaccessible and expensive. Perhaps the same is true of stock exchanges. That, you know, it's gambling. And so we don't want to have those kinds of cycles driving the economy. We should maybe discourage people from the kind of wild speculation that they do." You hear suggestions today sometimes that we should tax stock market trades and things like that. Those suggestions are very much coming straight out of a Keynesian kind of suspicion of whether those trades are really good or bad. So, problem is, investment and savings are going to be badly out of whack. They could be going in different directions. Now, how does that cause a problem for the economy as a whole? The problem is going to be, what happens when there's a lot of saving, but people are discouraged about investing in new plant and equipment because business conditions don't look good? In that situation, there's not going to be enough overall buying power in the economy because people aren't spending their money. They're saving it instead. And if there's not enough overall buying power in the economy, then goods will be piling up. Businesses will have to lay off workers because no one will be buying the stuff that's out there. We can begin to get a difficulty of what you think of as a vicious cycle. The vicious cycle is, it starts off in a situation where we're saving so much and not investing enough, so goods pile up and pile up and pile up, but then of course businesses lay people off because they can't sell what they're making. That means more unemployed people. That means less demand in the economy. So there's even fewer people buying stuff. And as a result, businesses will produce even less. And you see this downward cycle building and building where there's less and less demand and less production and less demand. This is an explicit attack on Say's law. It is an explicit defense of Malthus on the idea of gluts. Remember, Malthus's idea was there wouldn't be enough consumption out there in the economy because rich people wouldn't be spending enough money. Keynes is making more or less the same point, although instead of talking about just rich people, he's talking about the overall demand that exists in the economy all at once. So he writes, for example, "This analysis supplies us with an explanation of the paradox of poverty in the midst of plenty. The mere existence of an insufficiency of effective demand may and often will bring the increase of employment to a standstill before a level of full employment has been reached. And so he believes that as an economy becomes richer and more people are less likely, they're going to save up their money instead of spending it, and the difficulty is going to be that there won't be enough buying power out there, and the economy will gradually slow down and grind to a halt. Now, how does this particularly affect employment? There's one further stage in the argument. What could happen in a situation where there's not enough demand in the economy is you could imagine a situation where there are two ways that businesses could react. One way they could react is they could cut people's wages. For example, they could say, look, our business is down this year, we're off 5%, we're going to cut everybody's wages 5%. But everybody gets to keep their job. So we're not going to make people unemployed, we're just going to have wages go down and down. Another alternative would be to say we're going to lay off 5% of the workers. So Keynes said we have to understand why it is that businesses decide to lay off workers. Why do they create unemployment instead of cutting back on people's wages and sort of sharing the burden in that particular way? Well, Keynes argues that the reason for this can be seen by the following fact. Imagine two different situations. In one situation, there's 5% inflation. So the buying power of your salary is reduced by 5%. In another situation, your employer comes and cuts your wage by 5%. So your buying power is reduced by 5%. But in one case, it happens through inflation. In another case, it happens because they subtract off your paycheck. Keynes argues that it is true that people will go on strike over a cut in their pay, but they will not go on strike over inflation. Now he says, why is that true? Why does that make sense? And he argues it's really quite rational. He says, after all, with inflation, you know that everyone out there has taken a pay cut of 5%. Inflation subtracted 5% from everyone's earnings, so you're not at any particular disadvantage. But if your employer comes to you and says, I need to cut your wages by 5%, then that's singling you out. And you have no guarantee that everyone else is going to take a cut of 5%, so you may end up being the only one who takes a cut of 5%, while other people end up not taking as big a cut or not taking a cut at all. And so in order to protect your own status, you can accept an overall cut that happens through inflation, but not a cut that happens through a cutting in wages. So, when effective demand drops, businesses can't cut people's wages. If they try to do that one at a time, workers will go out on strike. Instead, what has to happen is that they lay people off, and that creates the unemployment that's out there. Now, what's the policy answer for this? The policy answer is, if there's not enough demand out there in the economy, then we need the government to pump up demand. We need the government to put more demand out there in the economy so businesses can be encouraged to hire people again, people can come back to work, they can start buying goods, and we can get a positive cycle going instead of the negative cycle that dragged us down into recession. Now, in terms of government pumping up demand, Keynes was pretty clear that he just wanted the government to put some money out there. He didn't really care a whole lot how that happened. He just wanted money to be out there in the economy. So in the general theory, he writes, if the Treasury were to fill old bottles with banknotes and bury them at a suitable depth in disused coal mines, which are then filled up to the surface with town rubbish, we could leave it to private enterprise on well-tried principles of laissez-faire to dig the notes up again. The right to do so being obtained, of course, by tendering for leases of the territory. If we did this, there would need be no more unemployment. And with the help of the repercussions, the real income of the community and its capital wealth also would probably become a great deal greater than it actually is. Of course, it would be more sensible to build houses and the like, but if there are political and practical difficulties in the way of this, the above would be better than nothing. You know, bury money in the ground. Let people dig it up. That will create jobs and put money out there. But do something. Don't just watch the economy sink into depression. He gives another example in terms of ancient Egypt. He says ancient Egypt was doubly fortunate and doubtless owed to this its fabled wealth, that it possessed two activities, namely pyramid building and the search for precious metals, the fruits of which, since they could not serve the needs of man by being consumed, did not stale with abundance. The Middle Ages built cathedrals and sang dirges. Two pyramids, two masses for the dead, are twice as good as one. But not so two railways from London to York. Thus we are so sensible, we have schooled ourselves to so close a semblance of prudent financiers, taking careful thought before we add to the financial burdens of posterity by building them houses to live in, that we have no such easy escape from the suffering of unemployment. So, you know, just do stuff. Build monuments. Do anything. But get money out there in the economy. When you're stuck in a depression, you gotta do something. How did Keynes alter economic thinking? How does this philosophy that we could have a shortfall in aggregate demand because of too much saving and a mismatch between saving and investment that could lead to unemployment, how does that really change the way we thought about the world? Well, let me begin to think about that question by first thinking about the predecessors of Keynes and how he used their work in ways which are a little different from what we expect. Keynes, in the general theory, does have discussions of many of his predecessors. So, for example, he acknowledges Bernard Mandeville and the fable of the bees. You remember that fable was, as long as these people spent lots of money and consumed a lot, the hive was really healthy. But then when the people became virtuous and started saving carefully, they all became poor. Keynes was like, that's exactly right. If you save too much, you're going to become poor. There won't be enough demand in the economy. You have to get out there and consume things. He even offered a limited defense of many of the mercantilists, who argued that, you know, you could have too much competition in bad times, and that would sort of drive down prices. And Keynes said, yeah, that can happen sometimes. You need to think about restraining it. He talks about Malthus on gluts, and he basically says, yeah, Malthus had it right. Malthus was correct in saying there are times when society saves too much. And when you save too much, you're not going to have Say's law operating. You don't have a balance between overall supply and demand, and things are going to fall apart. I should also say, though, that Keynes was not wholly original in this line of thinking that he proposed. There are a number of Swedish economists in the 1910s and the decade around World War I who are thinking very seriously along the lines that Keynes laid out and saying, look, we could have a problem where we don't have enough aggregate demand. We'd need to have the government spending in order to pump it up. So this idea of Keynes, like many of the ideas we've talked about in these lectures, is not 100% original. It didn't leap out of the sky suddenly. It's something that a lot of people were thinking about in a serious way for several decades up until now. Keynes was the one who really put it in a framework that seemed persuasive to most economists. Keynes really is more a follower of Marshall than of Marx or Schumpeter. Keynes is not talking about how the system evolves. He's talking about how it can get stuck in a rut and how you need to kick it out of the rut in some ways. And so I think that when I think about Keynes, I think of him sort of as thinking about moving from one equilibrium to another equilibrium in the style of Marshall, rather than society evolving through different stages and capitalism succeeding or falling. A second implication of how Keynes has really changed the world for us. Keynes argued saving could be bad. We have talked about no previous writer who would have believed that saving was bad. I mean, you know, Marx believed capitalist accumulation was vital. Mill believed accumulation was vital. Smith believed accumulation was vital. All those things were business people saving up and investing things over time. Keynes is the first one to come along and say, you know, there can be times when there's too much saving. There can be times when we need to have more demand and more consumption in the economy. And he really, I think, radically changed our thinking in this way. One way of seeing this is that in 1932, during the depths of the Great Depression, both Herbert Hoover and Franklin Roosevelt run for office on plans to balance the budget. They say, balancing the budget is fiscally necessary. We have to show we're responsible. Well, Keynesian thinking says if you're in the middle of a Great Depression and there's not enough demand, balancing the budget is exactly the wrong thing to do. That's the time when you should be burying banknotes in old coal mines. That's the time you should be building monuments. If you run a big deficit, just do it. I mean, in depression, you have to kick the economy forward. And actually, since the 1930s, whenever we have had a recession, we've just let the deficit go up, and we no longer have a call that says, doesn't matter that it's a recession, we need to balance the budget anyway. That seems to be broadly understood in the United States across both political parties. The tendency of many Keynesians is to believe that economies do tend to oversave, and that we need the government to help encourage spending and spur it along. A third change that Keynes brought to our thinking. Keynes really brought macroeconomic analysis to the fore. Interestingly, if you look up in sort of etymology and dictionaries, the word macroeconomic does not exist until the late 1930s and early 1940s. It literally does not appear in the language. It comes up first in some obscure writings by some Swedish economists in the late 1930s. All of the previous folks we've talked about, Mill, the Austrians, the market socialists, even Schumpeter, were really focused on firms and individuals and how that dynamic between firms and individuals would work itself out. Keynes was not focused on firms and individuals. He was focused on the overall system, on the aggregate amount of demand in the economy. And so that change really gave us a whole different way of thinking about what the government might do. Instead of having the government plan each little industry or change each little market, the government could instead think about, overall, what are we trying to accomplish? A fourth way in which Keynes changed our thinking, I believe that Keynes is really the one who gave us the feeling that government has the power and the responsibility to deal with unemployment and inflation and the economy in general. He sort of gave us a convincing framework for saying, if you're in a depression, somebody's at fault here. Somebody can do something about it. You don't just have to sit back and sort of say, well, the economy goes up, the economy goes down. Before Keynes, before the Great Depression, presidents were by and large not held responsible for the economy. It wasn't thought that they could really do anything about it. Since then, we really do tend to think of presidents as being responsible for the economy. I mean, it's part of what we'd expect them to do, is to manage it properly. And that idea is really an important one to all of us. We can't just sit back, in other words, and wait for the long run to arrive. In one of Keynes' most famous comments of this, in a discussion of monetary policy, he wrote in the 1920s, he said, in the long run, this is probably true, that, you know, the economy will keep growing. And then he says, but this long run is a misleading guide to current affairs. In the long run, we are all dead. Economists set themselves too easy, too useless a task. If in tempestuous seasons, they can only tell us that when the storm is long past, the ocean is flat again. You know, during a Great Depression, it's no good to say, well, this is a storm, but, you know, after the storm, everything will be better. You have to deal with the storm as you face it. Much of his analysis was about what to do now, how to rebuild after World War I, how to rebuild after World War II, how to recover from depression. Keynes was really focused on the issues of the day. Given this extreme policy focus, which, I mean, if all Keynes had done was his policy work, he would still be one of the great economists of the century. It's remarkable that he managed to somehow come up with a broad theoretical framework and contribution, which offered a broad way of thinking about all these kinds of problems and issues. And a final way, I think, in which Keynes really changed our way of thinking about the world is he had a philosophy, which I think of as a philosophy of correctable capitalism. It's been common to hear people say Keynes was anti-capitalist. You know, he thought the market would break down, therefore he was anti-capitalist. Schumpeter, you'll recall, sort of said if we didn't stick to old-style capitalism, kind of as it existed around 1900, then we had entered socialism, and you were either laissez-faire or you were not. Well, Keynes really had a more relaxed kind of view, that capitalism could coexist with certain kinds of government intervention, and it would still be capitalism. In the mid-1920s, he wrote, devotees of capitalism are often unduly conservative and reject reforms in the technique of capitalism, which might really strengthen and preserve it, for fear they might prove to be first steps away from capitalism itself. For my part, I think that capitalism wisely managed can probably be made more efficient for attaining economic ends than any alternative system in sight. And that in itself, it is in many ways extremely objectionable. Our problem is to work out a social organization which will be as efficient as possible without offending our notion of a satisfactory way of life. I guess the easiest way to think about this is an example he gives toward the end of the general theory, where he says, let's think about a problem where there's 10 million people in the economy and a million of them are unemployed. Now, does that mean that the market has failed or that capitalism has failed? And his answer is, well, it certainly failed in the sense that we have a million people unemployed. But that doesn't mean that the 9 million we've got are unreasonably employed. After all, 9 million might be in the right jobs in the right areas being paid about the right wages. We don't need to interfere with the market for the 9 million. What we need to do is raise the level of demand in the economy so businesses and markets have enough reason to hire the rest of the people. So, in that way, I think that Keynes can be thought of as, at ground, a friend of capitalism. Someone who believed that you could let capitalism do a lot of things, but sometimes you had to make sure that overall the aggregate balance got changed. As another obituary put it of Keynes, he was no believer in detailed controls and prescriptive centralization. On the contrary, he believed it was possible to create conditions in which this was unnecessary. His philosophy was to control the economic weather, not to issue detailed instructions about who should have umbrellas. In this way, you can think of Keynes really as a defender of capitalism. He believed overall you could let the markets run free, but every now and then you had to do something about the overall economic weather. What's the legacy of Keynes to modern economists? How has Keynesian thinking come down to us today? Well, there are at least three groups that are worth a brief mention, because you'll see them mentioned from time to time. And these would be New Keynesians, Old Keynesians, and Post-Keynesians. Old Keynesians tend to be people who are old 1950s and 1960s style Democrats. They tend to argue that the government really needs to make sure there's enough aggregate demand and investment in the economy. They tend to be people who believe that we shouldn't worry too much if the budget deficit gets big, and we should make sure the Federal Reserve makes sure there's plenty of low interest rates and money and credit in the economy. They believe that often aggregate demand is way too low and we need to do something to boost it up. Those are the old Keynesians. The new Keynesians tend to focus instead on thinking about reasons why wages and prices might not move very much. Now remember that Keynesian thought in the general theory is based on these ideas like, why don't savings and investment match up? Why do people feel differently about a cut in their wages that happens through a pay cut than one that happens through inflation? New Keynesians explore those kinds of questions in great detail. Why is it, they argue, that prices often aren't as flexible as we might think? Why is it that we can get imbalances in some markets that can persist for long periods of time? They often focus on problems of information and why markets might not be working very well if we're not sure about the quality of different goods or we don't have proper information about what we're paying. So they're not opposed to the old Keynesians, they're just focused on a different set of issues. And those folks tend to be, I would say, kind of neoliberal New Democrats, by and large. They believe in the market, but they also are trying to think about ways markets don't work very well and how one might deal with them. The final group, the post-Keynesians, tend to argue that the economy is full of monopolistic tendencies, and that's really the reason why the price system doesn't work so well. They argue that the cyclical patterns in the economy are pretty severe, and we need to do more about controlling the distribution of income, and some of them even favor things like wage and price controls in certain areas, because they believe the market really does not work very well. And those folks tend to be sort of what you might call your hard left-wing Democrats politically, or they often fall into that category politically speaking. Keynes planted a rich soil. He offered us a macroeconomic explanation for why the economy might break down, and in doing that, he offered us a defense of why we could let the institutions of the market continue and markets continue to work, as long as we paid attention to overall the shape of effective demand and unemployment.